The Trumpet Daily Program begins right now.
Today's world news, what it means, where it's taking us.
I bring you the one and only possible message of world peace.
This is a message of hope, tremendous hope. And he said unto me, you must prophesy again.
The Trumpet Daily Program begins right now.
Hello and welcome back to the Trumpet Daily Radio Show. This is Richard Palmer standing in for your regular host, Stephen Flurry. There's plenty in the news today. Europe, it seems, is heading for a major crisis. It's looking more and more like it's just going to be impossible for them to avoid a really serious crisis in 2017, a dramatic, world-shaking crisis. That's something that we'll talk about in the second half. But I want to start this program today by talking about an important event happening tomorrow that you have almost certainly heard absolutely nothing about. It relates to a trend that the Trumpet has been watching and writing about for 13 years. We've had a whole number of articles on this over that time. The first was by Mr. Ron Fraser. It's one we'll quote a bit from during this program. Today we're going to be talking about Europe's Galileo satellite navigation system. And this is something that personally I've written about periodically since, really, since joining the News Bureau back in 2007. It's something that I've had a few short articles back then. It's a project that's had a lot of ups and downs. It's mostly had a lot of downs, a lot of setbacks, a lot of delays, a lot of cost overruns, a lot of opposition. It's nearly been cancelled several times. It's something that people have written off as never going to happen on several occasions over the years, saying, well, that it's going to die, that it's not going to go anywhere, that the project is just too expensive, the cost overruns are too great, Europe is too divided. There certainly have been delays and been problems. But throughout all this time, generally at the Trumpet, we've been writing, well, Europe, they want an independent military from the US. They need this satellite navigation system for that to happen. It's going to go through. And so it's been with some personal excitement that I've been watching this story. And this project, it's finally and officially going to go live tomorrow. It's actually happening. Europe's Galileo system is here. After all the talks, after all the debates, this is happening. Europe is essentially now joining Russia and the United States in the top tier of space powers. To understand why this is big news, what exactly is going on, let's get some background on Galileo and on satellite navigation systems in general. So before we talk about exactly what's happening tomorrow, I'll talk a bit about exactly what Galileo is. So as you may have worked out already, Galileo is Europe's own version of America's GPS system. You know, the system that talks to your phone, to your sat-nav in your car, that tells you where you are with just incredible accuracy. It's Europe's version of that. But symbolically, it's far more than that. It's a declaration from Europe that in this high-tech world, they will not be dependent upon America. Because satellite navigation is far more important than you may initially think. Europe, according to one estimate, 10% of their economy is dependent on satellite navigation. And that is expected to grow to 30% by 2030. And that's huge. Now, I suspect that may well be massaged a little, but we'll look at just the wide areas of life that satellite navigation is used to. Now, it's absolutely fundamental to high-tech military, but even in civilian life, it's used in far more applications than you may think. Now, the most obvious are in navigation, in navigating cars, in aeroplane navigation, and a lot of Europe now, even right now, they use a combination of ground-based systems and America's GPS systems to accurately guide aeroplanes in for landing, as well as just aeroplane guidance while in the air. Then it's used in a lot of naval navigation. You have boats that even steer themselves using satellite navigation system. But then it's also used in heavy equipment in mining. So they have automated trucks and heavy equipment in mining that runs off satellite navigation system. It's used in farming. There is such a thing as precision agriculture, where equipment it will be, tractors and farming equipment will be guided to precisely spray crops or plow sections of field using satellite navigation systems. It will even be used to monitor in very granular terms just what crop yield is coming from what part of farms. So there's agriculture and mining areas that you would not necessarily initially associate with satellite navigation. It's used in surveying and in construction. Obviously, that's something that's a bit more obvious, and in building roads. It's used in archaeology. Now, use GPS to make a detailed 3D map of the site that they're investigating. Again, more of an obvious use. It's used in earth sciences and just in tracking plate tectonic movements and geology. It's used in satellite communication. If you're on the move and you need to communicate with a satellite in space, then you need to know exactly where you are on the Earth so that you can point your satellite dish towards the satellite. It's used a lot in logistics and tracking any kind of tracking services, generally tracking taxis, tracking packages. When you go and you just hit refresh constantly on your web browser waiting for your package to arrive, often the tracking company will be getting the information of where your package is and where the truck delivering your package is via some kind of satellite navigation system. Then more and more smartphone apps and uses are becoming based on satellite navigation in phones. Greeting apps, social networking apps, dating apps, things like the infamous Pokemon Go. And another more frivolous use, but even in sports training, you're getting lots and lots of use of satellite navigation. So this is becoming something that people make a lot of money from, that a lot of significant industries use. But where it really kind of comes into its own as being vital is the military. Being able to know where soldiers are in a unit in a battlefield with pinpoint accuracy is something that can really increase military effectiveness, can help avoid friendly fire, can help direct fire and just be really precise in terms of how targeting the enemy and knowing where your own troops can help avoid collateral damage and just really help planning. Then you have smart munitions, bombs, missiles, even artillery projectiles guided to their targets by satellites. And this amazing accuracy in these munitions has been a huge advantage for the United States. Then planes can use it to track their targets and even then pass that information on to missiles, and a whole load of just the way America's high-tech weaponry works is built a lot around this satellite navigation system. Now, on the surface, you'd think, well, Earth really needs one satellite navigation system. Now, what's the point of more than one guidance system? You're just replicating the same thing. Well, actually, there are about half a dozen different satellite guidance systems in various stages of development right now. Because each major power wants their own. It's something that's so vital for a modern military. It's something as well that, as we covered, civilian economies rely upon, that just about all major powers are developing their own because they don't want to rely on America's. So America's system, known as GPS or Navstar, that's pretty well known. Then Russia, they're one of the next most powerful. Theirs is called GLONASS. I will attempt and probably butcher the Russian name for it, Globalnaya Navigatsiyashchennaya Sputnikovaya Sistema. So GLONASS. That began in 1976, just a few years after America's GPS project got started. It was completed in 1995, but then went into pretty serious decline as Russia struggled for money in those post-Soviet days. When Vladimir Putin came to power in 2001, he made it really a top priority, gave it a lot more funding. By 2010, it was back to being able to cover all of Russia. By October 2011, GLONASS once again covered the world. And if you have a newer smartphone, there's a good chance it uses data from GLONASS as well as GPS to calculate its position so it can get its position more quickly and more accurately. And especially in a built-up area, having access to more satellites and alternative satellites to the GPS system does actually help, because buildings can block your view of one particular satellite. If you've got more available, you're more likely to be able to get information from a satellite and get your position. So GLONASS is the system that's already up in use. Then the Chinese have their own system, BIDAO. Currently, it only functions in the area around China, so China and then the Asia-Pacific region, and they aim to have global coverage by 2020. Then there's the Indian Regional Navigation Satellite System, and this is fairly recent. Their first launch was in July 2013. Its aims are more regional. They aim to have strong accuracy in India and then just getting weaker as you go out And then with that weaker coverage, covering an area around 1,000 miles around away from India's borders. Then you have the Quasi-Zenith satellite system, and this is being developed by Japan. They had their first launch in 2010, and again, it's going to be just a smaller regional system with just 4 satellites, and again, aimed to be complete by 2020. And then there's Galileo, and Galileo is really the most ambitious. Well, BDI is pretty ambitious as well, but one of the most ambitious of these new projects. It aims to be just about the best GPS system out there. So they have a free public service that would give it navigational accuracy to about 1 meter or 3 feet. And then there is a service that you have to pay for that would give an accuracy to 1 centimeter or a fraction of an inch. And unlike some of these other services, Galileo is worldwide. And as I said, right from the start, this was a system that was designed to make the EU independent from America. If they used America's system, well, that would give America effective veto power over the EU's military missions, at least if they wanted to use some of these high-tech weapons. America would be able to turn their system off if they didn't like what the EU was doing or block the EU's access. America actually did this to India in 1999 when there was a flare-up with Pakistan, and that's part of the reason why India is building their own system. Now, we've talked already on this show about how EU leaders these days are talking more and more about strategic autonomy, about not wanting to rely on America's military, and this is something where talk has dramatically increased over the past year or so. But this is something that shows that people were thinking this way 13, 14, 15 years ago or more. They saw this weakness, they saw here was an area that America was just fundamentally reliant, or that Europe was fundamentally reliant on America, and so they spent billions building their own version of what America had so they wouldn't have this dependence. Back in 2002, right at the start of this system, one EU report stated, Galileo will underpin the common European defense policy that member states have decided to establish. As time went on, they tried to market it more and more as a civilian system, but really, as we'll get to later, there is a fundamental defense aspect to it. They write, there is no question here of coming into conflict with the United States, which is and will remain our ally, but simply a question of putting an end to a situation of dependence. If the EU finds it necessary to undertake a security mission that the US does not consider to be in its interest, it will be important, or it will be impotent, unless it has the satellite navigation technology that is now indispensable. Although designed primarily for civilian applications, Galileo will also give the EU a military capability. So it's this independence from America that's at the heart of this EU project. Former French President Jacques Chirac, he said in 2001 that without Galileo, the EU nations would become American, quote, vassals. So this was why he was pushing for this project, to be independent from America. And in the very early days, a lot about Galileo was actually quite openly hostile to America. America was quite worried about this project. If America went to war with a nation and the EU did not approve, well, America worried that the EU would keep giving that enemy nation access to Galileo. And in fact, the EU initially, they were planning to have Galileo operate on the same or a very similar frequency to GPS. So this would mean it would be impossible for America to jam Galileo systems or shut down Galileo broadcasts without jamming their own GPS too. The EU, they even flatly told America that they would not turn off or jam their signals if they were being used by a nation at war with the US. And this kind of controversy blew up in 2004 when George W. Bush was US president. America had a bit more pride in its power than it did back then. And leaked US Air Force documents show that America basically told the EU to cooperate with them or they would shoot down EU satellites if Galileo was used by an enemy nation, a nation that was opposed to the US. At that point, the EU backed down. They changed frequencies. They made it easier for America to jam Galileo signals if they were being used by a nation America opposed. But it shows the anti-American thinking that was there at the beginning and at the heart of this project. The EU, they really like to emphasize that this is a civilian project. You generally see this right at the top of any press release or press statement about it. They're always making statements that say something like, well, unlike the American or the Russian navigation systems, which are controlled by the military, Galileo is a civilian system. but for all practical purposes, they're the same. The EU criticizes the US for being a military system, saying that the US military can turn it off in time of war, but the EU openly admit that they can do the same. They've said that they'll turn it off and leave only a service only available to military and emergency services in time of war. A German member of the European Parliament, Reinhard Bütikofer, a few years ago, he said that the European Commission had deliberately hidden how widespread the military uses for this project were. He said until 2011, documents did not even hint at the extent of the military uses of the project. Really, though, this has been the plan from the start. And as I said, though, EU leaders have tried to conceal just how militarily useful it is. As we mentioned at the beginning, Mr. Ron Fraser, he was really the first person at the Trumpet to draw attention to this Galileo project, and that was in an article titled Space War for the December 2003 Trumpet. And in that article, he quoted from a press conference given by the president of the German Aerospace Industrial Association, Rainer Hartrich. And the press release from this press conference, it stated, according to Hartrich, if Germany wishes to retain its internationally recognized position, then its involvement in spaceflight must be stepped up. The top priorities for our industry, Hartrich pointed out, are securing an independent German means of transporting satellites into orbit, launch of German-led European satellite navigation system Galileo, and successful utilization of the independent space station. And this statement went on to say, the key to success in a military conflict today lies in air superiority. Superiority must be established both in German airspace, homeland defense, and also in potential operational theaters, defense. And again, he writes, again and again, we Germans have been the driving force behind the growing together of Europe in the last few decades. What we would like to see is a similar German role as the driving force in European defense policy and its projects. And this was he saw this as a key project of the German defense policy of pushing for this Galileo navigation system. So the system has now reached officially tomorrow will reach its initial operational capacity and will go live in that initial operational capacity. And until now, only the two Cold War superpowers, Russia and the United States, have had a worldwide navigation system. And Europe is joining them, a symptom of their status as a new rising superpower. So the system now has 18 operational satellites. It needs 24 to be fully operational, and they plan to launch another 8 over the next 2 years, so they'll approach full operational capacity pretty soon. Ultimately, they aim to have 30 satellites up there so that there's some redundancy, and they have some spares, and they aim to have all of those up there sometime around 2020. Agency France Presse, writing on this launch reaching initial operation capacity tomorrow, all right, 17 years later and more than 10 billion euros later, Europe's Galileo sat-nav system is set to go live on Thursday, promising to outperform US and Russian rivals while boosting regional self-reliance. They go on to write, somewhat fuzzy at first, the signal will be boosted with help from satellites and the US military-run GPS system, growing stronger over time as orbiters are added to the now 18-strong Galileo network. Then they quote Jean-Yves Legault, president of France's CNES space agency, and they say, GPS allows a train to know which area it is. Galileo will allow it to identify the track it is on. Now, it was way over budget. Initially, it was set to cost 2 to 3 billion euros and scheduled to be finished in 2008. And initially, the Chinese were set to be part of the project, but Europe and China kind of fell out, and China went back to making its own system. And that's part of the cause for all of these delays. But it's here. As of tomorrow, it will be operational. They made it. They made it because it was important for them to be independent of the US. And this isn't the only EU satellite project where they're aiming to be independent from the US with military applications. They have really a spy satellite program under the GMES, Global Monitoring for Environment and Security. All of their publications really emphasize the environment part of that. But if you keep reading, usually dug in somewhere, there will be something talking about the security aspect as well. It all focuses on climate and disaster monitoring, a lot of their literature. But then it does say that it will develop applications such as border or maritime surveillance. And they admit that part of its purpose is to act as European-wide spy satellites. Included in that project is G-Mosaic, that stands for GMES, Service for the Management of Operations, Situational Awareness and Intelligence for Regional Crises. And this will use satellite for intelligence gathering. It is, quote, for preemptive intelligence, which usually means spying on someone just in case. It says that they say that they'll monitor locations around the world. It will be able to help plan and provide detailed maps for, quote, possible strategic military missions. And that's from the EU's brochure, so they'll be using that to plan and organise military missions. Then they also have the Multinational Space-Based Imagery System. That's a more overt European military satellite project. And this is, you know, several European nations, they have their own advanced spy satellites, and this MUSIS aims to coordinate all of these systems. So I think those nations are France, Germany, Italy, Spain, Poland, Greece and Belgium, so they can all share data. I'm not sure exactly where that is in terms of operational. A few years ago, it wasn't yet operational, though Germany and Italy kind of and France had their own arrangement to share spy satellite data. So Europe is working on its space-based military technology, and this military focus is set to accelerate. Space News over the summer, they had an article titled EU Draft Space Policy Calls for More Military Involvement. And they write, a draft summary of the European Commission's space policy raises the issue of retooling Europe's Galileo navigation and Copernicus Earth observation programs to make them more attractive to Europe's military forces, whether Europe's space force in South America should receive Commission funding. The six-page summary, dated July and now being presented to European Union member states and European industry, raises the issue of Europe's continued dependence on the United States for an average of 60% of the payload electronics on board European satellites. So again, they're still thinking about this autonomy from America. How can we make ourselves less dependent on America? They go on to write, the document specifically mentions the Galileo positioning, navigation, and timing network now being assembled, whose resolutely non-military label tends to obscure the fact that the system includes a secure signal designed for civil security and military use. So again, they try and obscure this secure signal designed for military use. And one more quote from this article. They write, an industrial consortium is under contract to the European Defence Agency to propose a development model designed to build a GovSat system that would be owned by the EU. The consortium, or GovSatcom system, sorry. The consortium, which includes Airbus Defence and Space, Euroconsult, CDI, Hydesat, Space Tech Partners, and Italy's International Affairs Institute, is scheduled to produce its findings by the end of the year. So they're working on an EU secure military satellite communication system as well. So Europe is making some important major steps to being a high-tech military power, and they're really working on being independent here from the United States. Now, naturally, they still lag behind the US. The US has been working on this just about all through the Cold War. But Europe is just really focusing on those essentials that it needs to be independent. And they've joined now the US and Russia as being the only power blocks with this kind of worldwide capability. And as a reminder, here's a quick clip from Mr. Armstrong about what he said about the rise of Europe as a superpower alongside these other two.
10 nations, the Bible prophecy says, are going to unite in Europe, and they will be probably more powerful than either the Soviet Union or the United States. When all the nations of Europe get together, there will be 10 of them.
So this official launch of Galileo tomorrow is concrete proof that Europe is on that road, that they're rising to be their own superpower. They're reaching some of these kind of marks of superpower status. Now, there are still several roadblocks on that way. There's still a lot to be done. We'll take a quick break now, and when we get back, we'll start taking a look at some of the crises that they're facing and how that's going to force them to overcome a lot of those roadblocks.
This is KPCG-FM, and this is the Trumpet Daily.
Herbert W. Armstrong long forecast the arrival of a military superpower in Europe. In a world where European nations can't rely on the United States, one in which they fear Russia and face the constant threat of radical terror, their only hope of survival is to band together. This is what we see happening. And what we see happening was prophesied in your Bible. Request Germany and the Holy Roman Empire to learn about the history of Germany and the Holy Roman Empire and to understand where the events in Europe today are leading. 3,000 years ago, the prophet Daniel explained that at the time of the end, radical Islam would push against Europe. That time is now. We are witnessing the first manifestations of this Islamist push against Europe, and it's leading to a spectacular clash between these two prophesied kings, the King of the North and the King of the South. What does the Bible say about the identity of these two kings? What about the end time? Will everyone be affected by these events? Request our two booklets, The King of the South and Germany and the Holy Roman Empire. To learn more, please visit thetrumpet.com. The Trumpet Daily Radio Show airs every morning at 7 a.m. Central Time on KPCG 101.3 FM in Edmond, Oklahoma.
Hello and welcome back to the Trumpet Daily Radio Show. This is Richard Palmer standing in for your regular host, Stephen Flurry. Before the break, we were talking about a major unreported piece of news. Europe's Galileo satellite navigation system is going live, a system that will really help Europe's military be independent of the United States, and just a major sign that Europe is growing as a third world superpower. If you have any comments, if you'd like to email the program about anything that we're talking about, you can do that at td@kpcg.fm. And now we're going to talk about something that is in the news much more regularly, Europe's economic crisis. This is something we spoke about on Trumpet Hour exactly a week ago. But there's still a lot changing after this Italian vote, this Italian referendum that put things into crisis. And you know, this is something that is a crisis that is really building in Europe right now. And it's starting to get very hard to see how we'll avoid just a huge crisis for the EU over this next year. That it just seems like it's building to the point that it would be almost impossible for Europe to avoid just the worst outbreak of the euro crisis that they've ever seen. Something that would shake Europe to the foundation. Something that could potentially destroy the European Union. It seems very hard to see how they'll avoid that in 2017. So to recap what's happened so far, on December 4th, Italy took another step towards triggering a massive European economic crisis. The country held a referendum on constitutional reform, and it was rejected with nearly 60% voting no. Prime Minister Matteo Renzi, he had said that if it was a no vote, he would step down, and true to his word, he resigned. Now, at first glance, this doesn't really have much to do with the euro. It wasn't a referendum on the euro, or Italy's place in the euro. It was about constitutional reform. But as we'll see, it's already having knock-on implications. It's raising uncertainty for Europe's banking system that is facing big problems, and it is feeding into this growing Eurosceptic movement within Italy. Now, on December 12th, the former Italian foreign minister, Palio Gentiloni, he was sworn in as prime minister. He's appointed by the president and approved by parliament. Italy didn't hold fresh elections, and his government is accused of being, quote, photocopied from the old. It's a lot of the same faces that were in the old cabinet before. They've just basically changed prime ministers, shuffled a few people around, but it is very similar to the previous government, and that is building to this unhappiness within Italy. That shocking 60% no vote. A lot of people were expecting a no vote. The polls were forecasting a no vote, but a lot of people were still very surprised at how strong of a no vote it was, especially given that most of it, that all the traditional kind of political elite were saying vote yes, all of the bankers, the business leaders, the European Union, just about all of the elites were all saying vote yes, yet it was still this landslide for the no vote. And so Italy now is really facing two crises. And the first is a political crisis. Now, this is mainly a crisis from the European point of view. Italy seems inexorably heading now to a Eurosceptic government. And as we'll see, it's not just Italy. Ambrose Evans Pritchard, the Telegraph international business editor, he wrote over the last week or so that the government of Matteo Renzi has collapsed. The Italian establishment has suffered an earthquake defeat, more like the enveloping Bourbon downfall of the late 1850s than anything that has occurred in recent Italian history. The electoral laws are in chaos. That's something that we talked about on Trumpet Hour, where Italy was... They already reformed some of their laws in anticipation of a yes vote in this referendum. Now there was a no vote, and so the Italian electoral laws don't really make sense right now. And he continues to write, a once unthinkable left-right amalgam of anti-Euro parties is emerging with a real shot at power, perhaps as soon as early spring, if the country's president allows a snap vote. We could then have the spectacle of back-to-back elections in Italy, the Netherlands and France, each dominated by the overriding theme of regime change and each posing an existential threat to monetary union. The tail risks are colossal. So talk about a crisis facing the EU. Next year, you could get... There's the very real potential of victory for Marine Le Pen and Eurosceptics in France, victory for Geert Wilders and Eurosceptics in the Netherlands, victory for Beppe Grillo and Eurosceptics in Italy. These are three founding members of the European Union, absolutely right at the heart of Europe. This is, they're not like Britain that has kind of sat at the edge for all of these years. And in all of them, there's a very strong feeling that once their country out of the euro, what better proof is there that Europe needs radical change, that you're getting these kind of views right at the heart of the nation, of these nations? And you've got Italy, a southern European nation, the Netherlands, that's more lumped in usually with a northern European nation, so in all kinds of different circumstances, but they all want out of the euro. And a Eurosceptic vote in just one of these countries would shake the European Union to its foundations. Now, going back to this political earthquake in Italy and this article from Ambrose Evans Pritchard, he's been over in Rome in Italy over the last week or so, and I think this was a different article. He interviewed Claudio Borghini, a man being, as he said, tipped as a possible finance minister of any rebel constellation. He's a former broker for Merrill Lynch and Deutsche Bank. He's now a professor at the Catholic University of Milan. And he had an interview with him, and this Borghi, he said, we are coming to the point where Italy must make the real decision. Are we for Europe or are we against it? What is emerging is a list of four parties or groups who all have one thing in common. We agree nothing is possible until we leave the euro. And this is this man, continuing from this man, tipped as a possible finance minister for Italy. Europe has brought us a depression worse than 1929. It has led to entire peoples being broken and humiliated, like the Greeks, all for the sake of preserving the infernal instrument of the euro. This whole disaster has been adorned by a chain of lies, shouted ever louder, because they are afraid that the colossal damage they have done will be discovered. Going back to Ambrose Evans Pritchard, he writes, Dr. Borghi has said that the landslide 59% to 41% result in the referendum is a shock to Italy's powerful vested interests. Quoting from Dr. Borghi, they are absolutely scared because none of their tools of control are working anymore. And now going back to Ambrose Evans Pritchard, Professor Borghi is chief economic strategist for the right-wing Liga Nord, but what is emerging is a tactical alliance between his party and the Five Star Movement, which has more in common with the left. The two working together are running at 44% in the polls, very close to a majority. Their economists are working together in what is becoming a closely knit school of Eurosceptics. The grassroots of the Five Star Party have always been hostile to pacts with any other group, regarding the whole political caste in Italy as rotten to the core. But Mr. Grillo says the party is closing in on power and must be prepared to make compromises. We are in a spiral towards government, he said. So there's a very strong possibility that you could have a Eurosceptic group in power in Italy. And here's more on this. This is from Wolfgang Monschau. He's a very well-respected economics writer in the Financial Times, and he makes a similar point. He starts his article talking about something called target two imbalances, And this is basically talking about the flows of cash within the Eurozone. This is the system, well, this system shows money flooding out of Italy. And Munchar writes that at the end of November, these flows, these target two imbalances, reached higher levels than during the height of the Eurozone crisis in 2012. Germany's surplus is at 750 billion, while Italy's deficit is at 359 billion. So what it basically means is that money is flowing out of Italy and into Germany. And he writes that the bulk is due to what might be described as a silent bank run. So money is just hemorrhaging out of Italy's economy. He goes through all the options in this article for the European Union and shows that how it is right now, the euro just isn't working, and none of these solutions that could fix it, these are all quite radical solutions, but none of them seem at all on the cards right now, meaning that Europe is just heading for a crisis. He writes that one day Italy will be led by a party in favour of withdrawal from the euro. When that happens, euro exit would turn into a self-fulfilling prophecy. There would be a run on Italy's banks and its government bonds. Italy's fate in the Eurozone and the possibility of a President Marine Le Pen of France are two large threats to the Eurozone and the EU. If Italy wants to stay in the euro, it needs to send a clear warning to Germany and the northern European countries that the Eurozone is set on a path of self-destruction unless there is a change in parameters. The next Italian Prime Minister will need to explain to the next German Chancellor, presumably Angela Merkel, that her choice will not be between a political union or no political union, but between political union or Italy's withdrawal from the euro. The latter would imply the biggest default in history. The German banking system would be in danger of collapsing, and Europe's biggest economy would lose all the competitiveness gains so painstakingly accumulated over the past 15 years. So this, he's saying, is the choice for Germany. Either you agree to forming a superstate with the rest of Europe, or the biggest default in history, and probably the total collapse of the German banking system. That is what looks like is ahead for Europe in 2017. A crisis that forces them to come finally to this political union. Meanwhile, building in this crisis, running alongside this crisis, is a banking crisis that is building in Italy that will just feed the economic crisis. So Italy's unemployment rate is at 12.4%, far above Germany's 4.2%. Youth unemployment is at 40%. I haven't looked at the updated statistics, but at the start of the year in Sicily, one of Italy's poorest regions on that island there, youth unemployment was at 75%. Almost all young people under the age between 16 and 25 that are looking for work in Sicily just can't find a job. Its economy is barely growing. It's 10% smaller than it was before the 2008 economic crisis. Its industrial output is the same level that it was 35 years ago. And then that's feeding into massive debt problems. About 17% of loans from Italy's banks are not being paid back. That's somewhere getting close to $400 billion. And Italy's system after this, or Italy's problems after this referendum vote, could be about to get worse. One thing that could make it worse is tomorrow the US Fed, Federal Reserve is expected to raise interest rates. That's something that Mr. Robert Morley will be on next on Trumpet Hour, so stick around for that to talk about. And there are a whole host of other implications from that interest rate rise. But this would accelerate the flow of money out of Italy and to America, so that's something that could excavate the crisis. But then following that banking crisis, or that referendum vote, Italy's Bank de Monte Paschi, the world's oldest bank, Italy's most problematic bank, they were scheduled to negotiate a recapitalization to get basically some more money that they needed to keep going. They were meant to get that the day after the referendum. Then the no vote won, the bank failed to get the money that they needed. Then they applied to the European Central Bank to try and get an extension of the amount of time that they could have to get that money together. So after this massive shake-up of Italian politics, they wanted just some extra time to get the money that they needed, and the European Central Bank said no. And now it's looking like Italy may well have to bail out or nationalize that bank. This is adding to the uncertainty on the other banks. But it's also really adding to the anger at the European Union. Here's going back to Ambrose Evans Pritchard again. He writes, Italy is to nationalise the Banco Monte Placido di Siena as soon as this weekend, wiping out investors in a dramatic escalation of the country's banking woes and political crisis. The Italian Treasury has been left with no other option after the European Central Bank refused to give the crippled lender more time to clinch a deal with private funds. Shares of MPS, Banco di Monte Placido di Siena, instantly plummeted 16% on the Milan Bourse before trading was suspended, setting off tremors throughout the Italian banking sector. Junior bonds issued by the bank crashed by half within minutes, reflecting the estimated haircut under EU burden-sharing rules. He quotes here from Antonio Domani, the head of the banking union CGIL, and he said the ECB is committing a grave error. It is unacceptable. There must now be an immediate public rescue to secure Monte Paschi and head off any systemic risk in banking trouble. This is a matter of urgent national interest. And he says that analysts said it was extraordinary, or this is Ambrose Evans Pritchard, that the ECB ignored pleas for a delay, given that Italy has been in chaos since the collapse of Matteo Renzi's government, and that it should have dropped its bombshell during trading hours. And he quotes Lorenzo Codono, an ex-chief economist of the Italian Treasury, now at LC Macro Advisors. He says the decision is very strange. They're giving the impression that they want blood on the floor, perhaps by forcing a resolution of the bank to set a precedent. There is a risk that there could be panic and a chain reaction of investors start asking who is going to be the next victim. Now, one thing we've pointed out before is that EU's bank bailout rules mean that any bank bailout will hit the Italian people hard. So shareholders, bondholders, and anyone with over 100 euros, that's $109,000 or 100,000 euros, in deposits must take losses before the government can bail out the bank. Now, over 100,000 euros sounds like a lot of money, but if someone's got their life savings or their pension, if that's in the bank, that could easily be more than 100,000 euros. Even a small business could have quite easily have more than 100,000 euros in a bank account, let alone large businesses. They forced this on Cyprus back in 2013, and it devastated Cyprus's economy. It led to people losing their savings. It led to drastic pay cuts because businesses struggled to find the cash to pay their staff because they just lost so much of their bank balance. And back then, leaders of the European Union, it was so destructive that they promised that that was an exceptional case. But now it's the rule. And Italy applied a rule similar to this back in December last year, and it ended in one elderly man committing suicide after he lost his entire life savings. He'd tried on several occasions to withdraw his money, was told no, and he claimed that the banks have been accused of making these investments where people could lose all their money just look like normal savings accounts without explaining the risks involved. But can you imagine what would happen in Italy and the rage that would build up in Italy if just all these hundreds, if not thousands, of ordinary people, more than thousands, tens of thousands, lose their savings like this? And this is what Italy could be facing with a bank going under, and then with the blame placed directly at the European Central Bank, and then European banking rules meaning that ordinary Italians suffer. You can see why Italians are angry with the European Union, and you could see that anger easily growing further. Ambrose Evans Pritchard, going back to this article, he writes that Beppe Grillo, leader of the rebel Five Star Movement, was on the warpath within hours, exhorting Italy to take matters into its own hands and defy Frankfurt, saying bail-ins violate explicit constitutional safeguards for savers. And he writes the MPS crisis is likely to become a test of whether EU treaty law has supremacy over Italy's constitution, which would eviscerate Italian sovereignty, and bail-ins will be undoubtedly challenged in courts. So a lot at play now in Italy. A lot of anger building up against the EU and the possibility for banks going under, and just more anger building up against Europe. So it's easy to see how the EU could be heading for a major crisis, a crisis that could potentially destroy the European Union in the next year. Meanwhile, Greece wants in on the action. Now, Italy is sitting there, bringing the EU close to collapse, and so now Greece is kind of popping up back in the news to say, hey, causing massive economic crisis in the European Union, that's our job. So they've popped back up in the news. Their economy is still in dire straits. Here's some recent or some stats from a Geopolitical Futures article. It was published over the last week or so. So their debt is around 180% of their economy. Their non-performing loans, their loans that are not being paid back, are worth around $120 billion. That's nearly half of all loans in Italy to Italian banks are not being paid back. Their unemployment is at 23%, so basically one in four out of work. And of those 23% that are unemployed, three-quarters of them have been unemployed for at least a year. So a huge segment of the population just out of a job for long periods of time. And this Geopolitical Futures article states the Greek government regularly finds itself in a catch-22. Either the government carries out European Central Bank's reforms and therefore becomes public enemy number one, or it attempts to keep the economy running without the full backing of the EU. The very institution Athens looked to for help initially is now seen as dubious and problematic. Now, last week, the Eurogroup, that's the group of finance ministers of the European Union, they refused to sign off on a review of Greece's debt situation. Now, completing and them signing off on that review paves the way for Greece getting more help from the European Central Bank, more help from the IMF. But here, Germany is blocking them from getting that help. They don't want to open up more funds to Greece without more reform. And the big part of the showdown, without getting into too many of the details, is that they don't want to write off Greek debt. That is very unpopular in Germany, especially now with Germany going into an election year. And you can sympathize quite easily with German taxpayers. They don't want their taxpayers' money going to another country, going to Greeks. And I think most taxpayers in most countries would feel the same way. They were promised that this money that they lent Greece would be paid back. It is impossible for Greece to pay that money back, but Germany doesn't want to admit that to its voters. And they want to just kind of keep up this fiction that Greece will be able to pay that money back so that they can make it look like they kept their promise to their voters. And so going back to this Geopolitical Futures article, they write, and so this epic tug of war between Greece and the EU, led by Germany, continues as distrust of the EU mounts in Greece. Last May, Greece passed austerity measures worth 5.4 billion euros that greatly impacted taxes, health service, public utilities and pension funds. The government has stated that no more reforms will be accepted. Meanwhile, Germany flexed its EU muscles on December 8th and convinced the Union to propose that EU countries in March 2015 should start sending migrants back to Greece as part of a larger effort to prevent asylum seekers moving north. Such a move would excavate the political, social and economic pressures already facing the Greek government. So Germany's playing tough. They're starting to say, well, if you're not going to do what we tell you to do on your economy, well, we're going to start flooding you with migrants now. We'll send all of our migrants back to Greece. Going back to this article, they say there's no shortage of challenges looming in the EU's future. The unfolding of the Greece's economic tragedy will occur alongside Italy's banking crisis, the Brexit fallout, and slumping trade from the exporter crisis. Athens runs the strong risk of not having the funds to pay bills by June 2017. And this does not take into consideration large debt payments that are also due in July. A fourth bailout is not on the ECB's radar, and after 7 years, Greece is running out of capital, both literally and politically, to enact further austerity reforms. If the IMF and Germany can't agree on acceptable terms for IMF participation in supporting Greece, the Eurozone will be forced to bear the full burden of propping up the Greek economy. The latter option is undesirable for members of the Eurozone, as it will clash sharply with a rising nationalist sentiment in countries both funding and receiving economic support. So here's another potential crisis brewing within the EU for next year. We could see another Greek crisis in June, in July, and as these crises just keep rolling around, that anger both in the EU at Greece and in Greece at the EU is just building and building. So we could see a banking crisis in Italy, economic crisis in Italy, governments that want out of the euro in Italy and France in the Netherlands, or even all three, and this growing crisis in Greece. Now, during this whole time, Germany's room for manoeuvre is going to be very limited because their elections. It's going to be very hard for them to make the unpopular steps that would be necessary to really solve this crisis. And so it's just hard to see how any way of stopping this building out to the point that it just builds into a major out-of-control crisis. And this is something the trumpet has been watching for a long time, and even Mr. Armstrong saw just how this could lead to a European superstate. In 1984, he said a massive banking crisis in America could suddenly result in triggering European nations to unite as a new world power, larger than either the Soviet Union or the US. That, in turn, could bring on the Great Tribulation suddenly, and this will lead quickly to the second coming of Christ and the end of the world as we know it. So this is the dynamic we're seeing in Europe, a host of crises that just keep building and that leave Europe really no way out but to form this political union. Here's what Mr. Fleury said about this growing crisis on a Key of David program last year.
Now there's a financial crisis in Greece this very day, and it has connections to what I'm talking to you about today. It's going to, whether they temporarily solve it or whatever they do, it's still going to get worse and worse, and pretty soon the European Union is going to go from 28 nations to 10, as we have been prophesying to you for over 50 years. Because, well, it's right there in the Bible for everybody to see, and Germany is going to lead 9 other nations, and it will become a superpower to absolutely stun the people of this world, shock them in many ways. The Greece crisis is tied directly to the gospel of God, the good news of God, and people don't see it for the most part. Very few see that. And I want to show you why. Some of the people talk about how it's going to tear Europe apart. Well, in some ways it is, but in another way it's going to bring 10 nations together and strengthen them with all kinds of superpower status. So the whole of Europe is at stake in this crisis. And democracy is at stake. They're going to lose their democracy, as much as there is one today, anyhow.
So that's a couple of clips there from a Key of David program last year. And European nations, they are reluctant to unite now. They've made some significant steps, like that Galileo program that we talked about during the first half. But it's going to take a major crisis to make them come together. And it's hard to see how Europe could go through the next year without seeing that major crisis. Now, maybe they will. Maybe they'll find a way to muddle through. They have been very, very good at just finding a way to avoid getting to the core of the problems and just delaying it for a little bit. But just so much is building now. There's so many potential trigger points for this crisis building over the next year that it really does seem unavoidable. Sooner or later, though, you can be sure Europe, they'll be faced with the end of the European Union, with massive economic crisis, unless they make some major, major changes. And these crises, they'll be so big, they'll force those major changes. They'll bring about that superpower that we talk about so much on this program. And that will force Europe to whittle down to those 10 nations, as you heard Mr. Fleury say on that clip from the Key of David program. These crises, they're bringing about the final resurrection of the beast power, talked about in your Bible. But that is the good news, that this is the final resurrection of the beast power. And that's what Mr. Fleury really focused on that Key of David program, that it is building to the last superpower in Europe, the last resurrection of that beast power, the last power, one of these last nations to try and dominate the world, and one that is going to be stopped by Jesus Christ returning. That was the main focus of that program, and that is how this subject, how this Greek crisis connects to the gospel, like Mr. Fleury was talking about in that clip. It's leading ultimately to that good news, to Jesus Christ returning to this earth. Now, we have written quite a bit on this Greek crisis on the Trumpet website. If you want to go, you can always search for Greek crisis or Greek Euro crisis, and you can pull up a whole load more articles if you want more information. There's one from Mr. Fleury published right at the start that I still go back to quite often, called Did the Holy Roman Empire Plan the Greek Crisis? That just goes into so much detail on what is going on, where this is leading. If you want more information, you can go ahead and read that. That's about it from me today. If you want to write to us about anything happening on the program, you can do that at td@kpcg.org. stephenflowery.fm. I believe Mr. Stephen Flowery will be back tomorrow. Up next is Trumpet Hour. We'll be talking about more of the world news. I'm not on that, so you don't have to put up with me anymore if you want to tune in to that. And keep listening and tune in next time for Trumpet Daily Radio Show.